Good morning. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderpool.
It's Wednesday, August 21st from HPR2. It's The Conversation. This morning on the show, is welfare working to stop work? We'll review some of the numbers in the latest work versus welfare trade-off report. It places Hawaii in the number one spot for total dollars given to a recipient, and they're more than an entry-level job.
And we'll consider if it's possible to save Earth in the age of man. A PBS five-part documentary is in the works now, and for the moment, we'll focus on the wins and losses of the Aloha State.
This is The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Good morning, and good morning to you, my partner in crime.
Good morning, Beth Ann. I'm glad to see you're going to start the day off with a little controversy, get the adrenaline going.
Oh, we mean talking about welfare.
Oh, yes.
Well, we are. What would you say, though, to a Hawaii single mom having two kids living on government assistance equal to almost $50,000 annually? No taxes, no work. Maybe you'd ask how that's possible. According to the Cato Institute's Work versus Welfare Trade-off report released this week, Hawaii holds the top spot for total welfare dollars going to an average recipient. Locally, the Grassroot Institute says the work disincentive brings more than just a financial cost. It's perpetuating a poverty of self-reliance. Dr. Kaili'i Akina is president of the Grassroot Institute and joining us this morning for a new run at an old argument. You know, we've been hearing this for a very long time, the idea that it's easier to be on welfare than to work. And so why would someone want to make a transition to work? What do we say to that in this new report, which seems to be making the same point?
Well, good morning, Beth Ann. I want to clarify something. It's important to realize that the Cato Institute, which lines up the welfare benefits for all 50 states, is not talking about welfare recipients. It's not suggesting at all that they're lazy or don't want to work. What it's doing is pinpointing what's happening in the system. We, as a society, are making it more profitable for people to be on welfare than to actually go out and work.
That's the whole idea of the disincentive, and one that has existed for quite a while, because the first time they did this report was in 1995.
Yes, and it shows a continuing trend. Unfortunately, we happen to be number one in the nation, and that's pretty precarious for a state in which there are such high levels of unfunded liabilities and other financial challenges. It's something that's just simply unsustainable.
Looking at this, though, just to be clear for people who are listening and who haven't perhaps seen the report, this is somewhat of a hypothetical situation because they're looking at it, what they call an average recipient, a single mom over the age of 21 with two kids. They're assuming that mom is not working and that mom is getting a whole host of welfare benefits. And not every recipient, real recipient, would be receiving all of those benefits.
But absolutely.
Looking in the case if they were, this is what it would be.
We're talking about some statistical averages, which give us a pretty good idea as to what's going on. For example, the typical welfare recipient in this report receives about $60,590 in pre-tax benefits and cash. Now, when you compare that to the entry level of being a computer programmer, a teacher, or an assistant city prosecutor, it points out that it's more profitable to stay on welfare than to go out and get a job. Again, that's not speaking to the character of welfare recipients, but it suggests we've got something wrong in the system because we really should be creating opportunities and incentives for people to be in the workforce. That would be good for the economy.
Well, given the economy and what we've been through over the last several years, that may or may not have been a possibility. The question that the report seems to be asking now is, looking at this point going forward, are we going to let the system continue as it has been, which you say is unsupportable, and that's their point as well, or are we going to fundamentally look at how we deliver welfare benefits, not saying that they should go away, but how do you change the system? So how do you?
Well, first of all, we have to recognize that welfare is not the system. It's only the result of a much broader approach to managing our economy. Stephen Moore, a Wall Street Journal analyst, has put together a good amount of research that shows that the societies that have robust, economically competitive free market economies tend to produce those things that help the middle class and the poor far better than societies with high welfare programs. And so that's where we have to start. We have to look at the economic competitiveness of Hawaii, and we need fiscal policies that enable our economy to grow. And then that, as a result, will enable us to have a more reasonable approach to welfare.
Your point is that none of this exists in a vacuum, and everything is inextricably linked with everything else, which, you know, we kind of know. And yet here we are in the situation in which we find ourselves, and we have a lot
sure.
of benefits going out and an unsupportable situation with unfunded liabilities and more things that we can talk about in the next 3 minutes. Where do we go from here?
Well, the bottom line is leadership. See, leadership needs to look at the big picture. The Alec Laufer report, Rich States, Poor States, shows that states like Texas that have robust economies tend to provide the things that people who are at the lower end of the economy, the poor, as well as lower middle class, really need, or what we call fairness. So we need leadership that understands the economy. We have elections coming up in 2014. Now, Grassroot Institute is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization, but we encourage voters to be intelligent, to evaluate candidates as well as sitting officials on the basis of their economic policy.
But come back to this, looking
yes.
just at the welfare part of this for the moment. If you put that under your scopes and say, this is where we are now, what kind of transition do you see possible, given the state that we're in and the kind of politics generally that we have, to be able to create a sense of fairness and also a sense of opportunity?
Well, if we're trying to engineer a higher level of fairness and distribution of goods in society by working on the welfare system, we're at too narrow a level. And we have problems in terms of trying to change systems that have developed over decades. Instead, what we really need, and I'll have to say it again, is leadership. We need brave political leadership with a vision of a more robust, economically competitive economy. And when we have that as really the driving force, we will then give the guidance to the institutions that we have to result in greater fairness.
Meanwhile, you've got a lot of people who are still sitting at that very low end of the economy who are going to have some help. And all the talk and transition and leadership aside, what do you do for those people where they are right now?
Well, one little piece is a call for greater transparency and accountability. Certainly, this doesn't apply to all welfare recipients, but when I released this article, or at least our report on the Cato article, we were contacted by an actress who was very, very informative. She said that her acting company here in Hawaii had actually recruited her and used the welfare system as part of her compensation package and had instructed her and the other actresses and actors as to how to use the welfare system to supplement their income. And on that basis, she made the decision to come to Hawaii. Now, this story happens over and over again when we're giving an incentive to people to use welfare rather than to work. So those kinds of practices need to come under the microscope a little more, and we need to have a little better management. But bottom line, Beth Ann, until we change leadership at the highest levels, that's not going to happen.
So this woman is, in some ways, you know, being able to skirt a lot of issues with funding
sure.
and being able to pay taxes and do her, mm-hmm. what some would say, fair share. But that's not the average person. When we're talking about a mom with kids still in Hawaii today, this moment, very quickly, what do you think we have to do as a first step for that person?
Well, I do believe that we need to have a safety net. But the bottom line is this. Until we have a robust, economically competitive economy, we're not going to be able to afford to actually serve such people. And so I'm going to say it again. It goes back to leadership.
All right. We're going to have to leave it there. Thanks so much for coming in. William Kalii Akina, PhD, is president and CEO of the Grassroot Institute Hawaii. He says his mission is to develop the public policy think tank into a society-transforming champion of freedom in Hawaii and the Asia Pacific. If you'd like to see the Cato Institute's Work versus Welfare report for yourself, it's on the website, hpr2.org. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. Later in the show, Sister Roby nods to Motor City, smile and frown offensives in Asia, and a planetary rescue. But first, finding Snow White in the backyard.
Umurokai, Ulanai, Umau, Ukaholabe, Ohangai.
For today's backyard quiz, we're asking you to get in touch with your inner bird watcher. It might not be as difficult as it may seem because you've probably seen the bird we're after. This one's about 20 inches long at maturity, pristine white. Its manner of flight is one of its most distinctive features. The head and neck are tucked in. The motion of its wings is slow and graceful. They travel in large flocks to their feeding areas and nest in groups, building homes for their young in mangrove or kiawe trees. You're likely to see them near a wetlands where they often forage for crayfish or insects. Their call is a hoarse quark, repeated frequently when disturbed, and maybe you can relate to that. The Latin name is Bubulcus ibis, and if you already knew that, perhaps you can tell us its more common name. Post it on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, and we'll be back with it in the next half hour to let you know if you're right.
Hi, good morning. I'm Dr. Michael Greger from NutritionFacts.org. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR Hawaii Public Radio. Join the conversation on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation.
You might look at it this way. Hawaii could be the planet Earth in microcosm. A place where nature's balance has been thrown off. Species have gone extinct here in record numbers. Invasive plants and animals have done all kinds of damage. Our islands have many cautionary tales to share. And lead scientist for the Nature Conservancy, M. Sanjan, travels the globe to chronicle the natural world and our place in it. He's filming a documentary called Earth in the Age of Man, working on another project about climate change. He's in town to work with our Nature Conservancy here. He's with us this morning. Good morning, Sanjan.
Good morning, Chris, and thanks for having me on Hawaii Public Radio.
You're a fairly frequent visitor to Hawaii, right?
It seems that way, yes. This is my, I think, third trip within a year.
Does Hawaii have a great deal to teach us in a larger context?
I think your analogy is fantastic. I mean, in a lot of ways, the way Hawaii goes, you know, it is a bit of a canary. It tells us what might happen to the planet in the future. But it also gives us the opportunity to see how humans and nature can adapt and work proactively to do something about it.
You know, it has occurred to me in the past, Sanjan, with projects about restoration of native forests and restoration of the reef, that in a way Hawaii is a good size to try to do a rebuilding restoration project and have it not be overwhelming.
You're right. I mean, you don't want to ever see the place you live in as a living laboratory, but in some ways that is what it is. The Nature Conservancy in Hawaii, for example, is working on two big restoration projects, one with invasive plants in the hills, focusing on a fern that is non-native to Hawaii, and using very sophisticated imaging technology and helicopters to identify those ferns and get rid of them. The other is the super sucker, which you might have heard about, which is which is out in the bay and basically pulling up algae and another invasive aquatic plant, and then replacing it with native sea urchins, which will keep the reef healthy, full of fish and full of color and life. It's a good size island to do these experiments on and to do them at scale. And what we learn here, we can apply not only on the mainland, but also around the world.
One of the things that we seem to be learning is that it's not all doom and gloom, that there are some successes that are actually possible, yeah?
I mean, I think that's the, you know, we're talking about this previously, but, you know, when you fly into Hawaii now, when you land in Honolulu, and I've been coming here since I was a grad student, really, you see the number of solar panels going up on houses. It's a really positive sign. If the mainland basically accepted solar panels and solar electricity as much as they do here in Hawaii, you know, we would make a big, big jump towards moving into a clean, green future. So, yeah, I mean, I think in some ways, being on an island means that you're an early adopter. You're sort of forced to make some changes. And when you do that, you can see the impact.
It's funny because we do have a mindset here in the islands of thinking of ourselves as late adopters. But and I think in areas that are relevant to the environment, it is just the opposite with things like solar.
When you live on an island, I come originally from Sri Lanka, so I understand sort of island living.
Uh-huh.
You're living here and you're here for the long run. And you understand the permanence of place. You understand your place in it. And, you know, look, there's no... The fact that these islands supported a huge population pre-contact, for example, with sort of Western civilization, just gives you an indication of how good humans can be of managing and working in their environment,
mm-hmm.
and what happens when we get it out of whack. So, yeah, absolutely. Living on an island does, in some ways, make you a late adopter. Movies come here late, maybe.
That's what I was thinking about.
I understand that. But in other ways, you are forced to adapt to the environment. You know, this island will have to adapt to climate change, to adapt to sea level rise, frequent storms, changing weather. I mean, so in terms of a sentinel for climate change, Hawaii, I mean, Keeling put out the observatory on Mauna Loa to record carbon dioxide in 1958. And mm-hmm. it's been recording carbon dioxide since then, unchecked this entire time. The longest record we have of carbon dioxide emission on the planet comes from Hawaii. There's a reason why he put it here.
Somebody was really prescient back then.
Absolutely. So in some ways, people who live on islands are forced to adapt. And that's a fantastic, you know, if you really study that, you'll get a good insight into what we can do elsewhere.
That's a good point, because there is a sort of a sense that we're a little backward, you know, by being isolated. I think that's part of a, you know, there is that in the local culture.
It's probably misplaced. I think people, and especially people who, you know, indigenous communities around the world, they are exquisitely attuned to what's going on in the environment. I mean, we've lost it, let's be honest, in the last 20, 30, 100 years. But certainly that understanding of the land is still there. You know, you talk to fishermen about the changing oceans. You talk to ranchers in Texas. They're on the land every day. They see what's happening. They understand climate change. They may not want to make the link to the fact that humans are causing it, but they know that something is changing on the land. I think it's the same thing with islanders. We get when something's changing.
It's ironic that scientists have to talk to non-scientists to find out the truth that's been in front of us for, you know, centuries, right?
Absolutely. Well, look, even people who are out there every single day and make a living from it, I think are really attuned to changing conditions.
Sure. With regard to climate change, which has been affirmed by yet another international conference, why is there such distrust of it? Are we moving toward a distrust of science in general?
Well, look, I'm working on a big project for Showtime called The Years of Living Dangerously, and it's got, you know, James Cameron as the executive producer and an incredible range of casts, and they've sent me on this year-long journey to look at the signs of climate change. It's partly the reason why I'm here in Hawaii, and I just came from Christmas Island looking at that. I do think there is a distrust of science, and I think that it is because we have not invested in science education in kids for probably 2, 3, 4 decades. During World War II, we made a big jump.
Right. Space age.
Space age and technology, and we understood science and the importance of science of getting us out of this mess that we were in. But I think it is gone back down, and now people are just as likely to believe in ghosts or the tooth fairy or UFOs as they are to Science Report.
That's very troubling.
It is troubling, although I do see changes happening. You know, look, it took, you know, when Lister came up with this notion that there were things called, you know, bacteria and microbes.
That you should wash your hands.
That you should wash your hands before touching a patient, for example. It took a couple of decades. That happened in Europe, but it took a couple of decades before it became practice amongst the medical community here in the United States. President Garfield, who was shot and assassinated, could have been saved if the doctors, the American doctors who were treating him, had accepted Lister's methods. He died of an infection, not the bullet. You know, so I think I'm seeing a sea shift of change. I do think that in 5 years from now, if we were having this conversation, 10 years from now, certainly if we were having this conversation, you and I would feel differently about where the United States is. I just worry we're going to have to deal with it. The sooner we deal with it, the cheaper it will be.
Well, Sanjan, I hope we don't have the conversation when we're up to our necks in ocean water. I mean, I'm exaggerating, but you know what I'm saying.
I think it's the frequency of storms and the intensity of El Nino impacts that I think that's what I would worry about, and how that gets ratcheted up when climate change supercharges the atmosphere and makes things tougher. But, you know, I see light at the end of the tunnel. But I also know there's a train barreling down behind me. And the big question to ask is, will we get out of the tunnel before the train hits us?
Well, that's a question that's going to have to hang in the air, but I'm really glad we had a chance to talk, Sanjan.
And you can watch the Showtime show and see it.
There you go.
Thank you.
M. Sanjan is the lead scientist for the Nature Conservancy and a science and environmental contributor to CBS News. He's at work on a documentary about climate change and a 5-part PBS documentary called Earth in the Age of Man. You can learn about him at hpr2.org.
Poets explore deeper meanings of pretty much everything.
You know, when the stock market goes down 500 points a day, one day, and then 2 days later does the same thing, I mean, how can you not feel like you're losing control?
I'm Kai Ryssdal, Literary Expression and the Great Recession, next time on Marketplace. It's from APM.
This evening at 6, following Bite Marks Cafe.
Hawaii Public Radio is extraordinary in many ways. One is that despite the modest size of our community and the challenges of island terrain, HPR offers 2 distinct program services to the whole state. We gratefully acknowledge Virginia Taylor of Kapolei, David Marks of Kailua, and David Winnett of Eugene, Oregon. Thank you for your support. Station membership is a choice. Are you a member? Follow the support link at hpr2.org. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. It's 8:28. You're listening to The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Travasa Hana, an experiential resort on Maui, whose partnership with Mokulele Airlines and Enterprise makes getting to Hana convenient with daily flights to Hana and one-way rental cars. Travasa.com/Hana.
If you've ever tried to get public records from government agencies, you know how frustrating that can be. But now there's help. A new public interest law center has just opened to help reporters and others get access to government information. CivilBeat.com editor Patty Epler joins us for today's reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
And perhaps we should say congratulations, too, because this is the Civil Beat Law Center for the Public Interest, and it's been created with funding from Pierre Omidyar. And although it has the name Civil Beat in it, we should also say that it's not necessarily affiliated with you per se.
Yes, that's true. It was, as you say, created by the Omidyar Ohana Fund, actually, for the benefit of all the media as well as the public throughout the state who are having trouble with government transparency issues. So open records, open meetings, that sort of thing. It's a way to get some actual help and advice on how to go about getting those items.
For anybody who we mentioned in the open who's tried to do that, it can be not only an expensive proposition and one you probably can't afford to do, but time is involved and a great deal of it. What is the center actually able to do for someone who is having problems getting records of whatever type?
Well, you're exactly right about the expense, and that was really the reason that we decided to start this center. As we've talked about on this program before, and in fact just yesterday, you know, when you can't get the government to answer a question or provide you with information that's legally required under the law, it can really be a deal breaker when you have to spend thousands and thousands of dollars on court costs. So the first thing is that the center will be able to give you advice, give people advice on what is and isn't available under the law, and then how to go about getting it, possibly write some letters on behalf of people who need help that way. There will be a media hotline that people from all over the state can call to ask their questions.
And the most important thing for a lot of people to know is that this is not going to cost them anything to get the help.
Yes, and that's what the Omidyar Fund, you know, really wanted to do, was sort of take that barrier down. You know, people just do not pursue what they should have a legal right to because of the huge expense, but then this absorbs that cost. And the new attorney that's running it is a guy named Brian Black, who most recently was with Honolulu Corporation Counsel's office. So he has, you know, quite a good bit of experience in government, on that end of government, let's say.
Well, it's already open as of now, and we'll post the email line. So in case someone has a question or a real concern, they can perhaps get an answer and one pretty quickly. Thanks so much, and congratulations again.
Oh, thanks a lot, Beth Ann.
Civil Beats, Patty Epler, she's the editor of civilbeat.com. And again, we'll post that for you so you can find out how to get in touch with the new law center.
Tonight at 5, it's Bite Marks Cafe with Bert Lum and Ryan Ozawa. I've got Bert on the line, and Bert, technology is really helping us understand marine life in new ways, isn't it?
Well, yes, Chris. You know, there's all kinds of technology, and we've actually featured a number of different types of cams that people are strapping on to, especially some of the sea mammals, and in this case, the monk seal. And we've invited some folks over from NOAA to tell us a little bit about their critter cam. And I guess, you know, what's really being addressed here is that I think there might be some misperception of what monk seals do in terms of their habits and behaviors. And that's resulting in a number of killings, I think, that are taking place. And what the folks over at NOAA are trying to do is use this technology to really understand what the behaviors are of these monk seals, and then try to report back that, you know, they perhaps aren't the ones that are out there perpetrating this deed against fishermen or whoever is out there killing them. So I think it's kind of interesting, and critter cams is one technology. There's cell phone tags. There's also these three-dimensional accelerometers that kind of give you a sense of how they're moving around. And I think this same technology is going to get extended to sharks, because there's a new study that is being funded to try to understand the behavior of tiger sharks.
Well, it's pretty amazing what these now newly miniaturized devices can do, because you can attach them right to the animals, and that's what they've done with the monk seals. And yes, clearly learning a lot.
Yeah.
Thanks very much, Bert.
Sounds good. Thanks, Chris.
All right. That's Bite Marks Cafe at 5 p.m.
We often hear how Hawaii is the gateway to the Pacific. With the focus of U.S. foreign policy pivoting to Asia and Hawaii's strategic military function, for a lot of us here, paying attention to Asia is more than just academic wonkery. In another of our Views from Here conversations, we're checking in with Ralph Casa, president of the Pacific Forum CSIS. He's just returned from Taiwan and discussions with President Ma and other key officials. Nice to see you.
Great to see you, Bethany.
For the few minutes that you're actually home before right. You're off and running again, you're going back to Taiwan on Friday.
Right, and Korea and Japan.
The frequent places and frequent flyer miles on your account, I don't even want to imagine. What happened this time around when you were in Taiwan recently? Is there really a coalescence of ideology? Are we really looking at a one China?
No, I don't think so. I mean, everyone has a one China policy, but everyone interprets it differently. And what they really interpret is, you stay where you are and let us stay where we are, and we'll both pretend we're part of the same China, and then we'll live our independent lives. I was there for the first anniversary of the East China Sea Peace Initiative, which has been President Ma's attempt to sort of insert himself into the China-Japan squabble. So it's been very interesting to see Taiwan try to play the peacemaker role after a number of years of them being called a troublemaker across the straits during the previous administration.
How well do they do in that role?
Well, they're doing well as far as their own relations with Japan are concerned. Of course, anytime the mainland sees Japan and Taiwan cooperating, it puts the worst possible spin on it and just becomes paranoid. So it doesn't make the mainland happy. But on the other hand, compared to where cross-strait relations were 10 years ago, right now they're pretty good.
Earlier this month, we had Taiwan ending sanctions against the Philippines after the issue with the fisherman who was killed. Is that a good sign?
Well, I think it's a good sign. I think we've had a happy ending. I wasn't particularly impressed with the way Taiwan went about it. And a lot of people said the Taiwanese were acting like Chinese. You know, they were sort of flexing their muscle. The Philippine action was inexcusable. I mean, there were hundreds of bullet holes in this ship. The captain was clearly murdered, and that's been the result of a joint investigation between the two sides that there'll now be criminal charges against the Philippine Coast Guard. But Taiwan really flexed its economic muscles against the Philippines. And while they can do that, while it was politically popular, Taiwan doesn't have a lot of friends in Asia, and it has to be real careful about how it treats its friends. The same holds true with how it deals with Japan over the disputed territories.
We only have you for a couple of minutes. I want to scoot on a little bit. Looking at North Korea and perhaps having families able to reunite with each other, is this a positive sign or is this spin?
Well, it's both. It's great that they've talked now about reopening Kaesong Industrial Park. The North Koreans have signed a 5-point agreement that says they promise that they won't play politics with it anymore. This is sort of like getting Lucy to sign an agreement that she won't pull the football away from Charlie Brown. You know, it's nice to have that as a piece of paper. We'll see if it actually works. The real tragedy in Korea has been the divided families issue. And these are people who are 80 and 90 years old now, and they have brothers and sisters in the North or in the South. And the North sort of plays hardball with that. But it's an important issue. If they can get another round, another couple of rounds of dialogue between these people from a personal standpoint, from a human relations standpoint, it's very important.
And targeted for September, do you look at that as being a reality or just sort of
it's
probably not?
You never bet a lot of money on anything that the North Koreans promise to do, because the North Koreans are trying to now tie it to opening up Mount Kumgang, which is a resort area which brings in millions of dollars. And the South has essentially closed that since a South Korean tourist was shot to death there a couple of years ago. So, you know, will the South give on that? The South has been pretty insistent that they want some sort of assurances if they go back to the Kumgang resort area that they're not going to get people shot in the future. North Koreans would have to sort of acknowledge that they shouldn't have shot the last one. And, of course, North Koreans aren't good at acknowledging past mistakes. So I wouldn't, if I was one of the divided family folks, I wouldn't pack my bags yet. But certainly the hope has been raised. That's part of the cruelty of this, is that
these people don't have a lot of time. I mean, you're talking about people who haven't seen their family members since maybe the early 50s.
Right, since 1952, whatever, 51. So, and they're all getting old, you know. So a lot of them have already died, people on the waiting list to see, and many more will be dying in the next couple of years. That's just Mother Nature. So it's really cruel to sort of hold out this hope and then pull it away. But that's what the North Koreans do. That's, you know, it's part of their leverage. Is to try to get as much as they can out of what should be a humanitarian gesture just for decent reasons.
And not necessarily just slapping on a happy face to try to look good to the rest of the world.
Right. And the Chinese have been pressuring them to sort of clean up their act, and they have to, you know, keep the Chinese, if not happy, at least stop them from being unhappy so that the oil and food, and et cetera, will continue to flow. So you get this, you know, sort of next month they'll be frowning again. Last month they were frowning. This month it's smiling. So, you know, it's hard to put a lot of faith in it. It's good when it happens. When they're smiling, they're not biting. But they have proven that they can do both.
And you know it's going to vacillate, so not accepting that one or the other is going to be the prevailing condition. As you're going back to Taiwan in just a couple of days and be having more meetings there, in general, do we need to readjust the way those of us here in Hawaii are regarding Asia?
Well, I think so. I mean, Asia is extremely important. Asia is not China. A lot of people think of Asia and think of China as the two being interdependent, but there's an awful lot going on in Asia above and beyond China. China, I tell people, beware of the Wizard of Oz effect. You know, everyone is looking at this great big figure on the screen and nobody's looking behind, you know, seeing that they're still about 4'10", casting a big shadow. You've got Indonesia. You've still got Japan is the third largest economy in the world. South Korea is growing. Indonesia is incredibly important. So there are a lot of countries we need to be paying attention to in Asia.
And looking behind the smiles and the frowns and the changing conditions of both.
Right.
Ralph, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Look
anytime.
Forward to talking to you the next time you're home, whenever that will be at
Great.
Some future point. Thanks very much. Ralph Kosa is president of the Honolulu Bay Pacific Forum, CSIS. He's a board member of the Council on U.S.-Korean Security Studies and the National Committee on U.S.-China Relations. For 30 years, he's been a political and military affairs and national security specialist for the Asia-Pacific and Near East South Asia regions.
Hi, good morning. I'm Brooke from Bishop Museum. You're listening to The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. Find out more about the show at hpr2.org.
And now back to our own little piece of the Pacific. Today we asked you about a bird that's a familiar sight in Hawaii's wetlands. It feeds on crayfish and insects and has one especially unfortunate habit. It tends to congregate near airports and can be a collision hazard. The birds are about 20 inches long and like to travel in flocks, so pilots need to be on the lookout. They're common on Oahu, Maui, Kauai, and the Big Island, less so on Molokai and Lanai. The Latin name for this group flyer, Bulbulcus ibis, identifies it as a long-legged wading bird, and it has the distinctive profile of a member of the heron family. This morning we asked you for its more common name, and if you said catalegrid, well, you're right. That does it for today's backyard quiz, but if you've got one for us, send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Sister Robi is on the move. 20 years into a multiple award-winning career rooted in traditional Hawaiian and Tahitian songs, she's delving into jazz and popular standards, even a bit of Motown. Her stylistic departures fill her new CD and will be part of her weekend concert. But no worries, some of your favorites are on the program too. Robi Kahakalau and her guitar are here with us this morning, and if we're lucky, we may get a bit of both. Good morning, Robi.
Good morning. How are you folks this morning?
All right. You know, you're at the point in your music where you have, you know, fans who expect certain things from you, right?
Yep.
And yet you obviously want to do something a little new every time you come out, right?
It always seems like there's the end result is the mixed plate format that I'm always end up with every CD. But on this latest one, I did dabble a little bit into the jazz because my mom's favorite, all-time favorite is always going to be Blue Eyes, old Frank Sinatra.
Mm-hmm.
And Chris and I, we just talked a little while ago. I said, I wish I could play the song, but it's way beyond my guitar playing abilities. So singing is fine, but I definitely need an accompanist for that one.
What was it like taking on that kind of material?
I loved it, but I actually had to practice the song before I recorded it because it's not, you know, not your basic three chord blend together. But it's a beautiful song, Frank Sinatra's One for My Baby and One for the Road.
Well, great. You know, you've got long experience in kind of finding the emotion that fits the song, right?
Yeah, and I really enjoy it. Well, to me, I always say that I have to sing songs that mean something to me.
Sure.
And that normally have a good message. And this is definitely, it might not be the best message because it's somebody in the bar at 3:30 in the morning when it's about to close. But, you know, it's a life story that kind of describes my life. I don't hang out in bars that late anymore. I prefer the happy hours nowadays. But
sure. It's
still, you know, part of a musician's life to have one more for the road. And just the whole song of doing something jazz to make my dad proud and then to please my mom with her favorite Frank Sinatra.
And also, you know, musicians know what it's like in a bar at closing time, right?
Exactly.
When everybody's gone
exactly. Home,
they're putting the chairs on the
yep,
tables.
And the right. Bright lights come on. Yep.
Well, at the same time, you know, there's that feeling. And do you approach a song, you know, looking at the lyrics kind of as a message to be gotten across, you know, really give a lot of thought to what it is you're trying to say?
I normally try to, well, it's probably not even on purpose, but I always end up saying that my songs tend to be more on the happy side, more on the positive message,
mm-hmm.
instead of saying, you know, like being angry with the world and wanting to change. I want to change some things, but in a happy way.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you've noticed, but there's hardly ever any minor chords in my songs.
Yeah, I have.
That makes it sad. And a lot of people do notice it. And it's probably because I would like to play feel-good music and feel happy music.
More. Well, let's. Why don't you give us a little example of that, and I'll. If I can get this thing in tune, I might even throw in a few licks with you.
You're in tune. We good. Checked it earlier. This is a song. My sister is a beautiful songwriter, and this is a song. She lives on the Big Island by Waipio Valley Lookout.
Uh huh.
So
oh,
most
beautiful.
Of her songs talk about Waipio, and this here is a song on the CD called Na Pali Alolua, which means the two pali facing each other.
Uh huh.
And it's in G.
Okay. Good. Pali alolua o waipio ho'opulu
inapali uluvehi aloha. Aloha e ku aina o waipio. He aina pulama mai kahi komai. Hoi mau ku umana o laila. Beautiful, Chris. What are you doing this Saturday evening?
That's a really sweet song, you know, and what you were saying about major chords,
yeah,
they really do bring that sort of optimistic, positive yeah. feeling to it. Just, you know, what we call cowboy chords, right?
Yeah,
nice big
definitely.
Open strings ringing. And but, you know, that's the beauty of the acoustic guitar, don't you think?
I definitely do think so. And to me, some people, you know, fancy chords. My dad was all about fancy. I call them fancy chords. The, you know, the break your fingers. They're beautiful, but I'm the harmonies is one of my favorite things to hear. A song in two part harmony is fine, but three part is even better. And open chords, open tuning, open
well,
chords.
Well, you know, Roby, there's a saying that a pop singer sings three chords, plays three chords for 1,000 people, and a jazz guitarist plays 1,000 chords for three people.
See, that's very,
so
very true.
You've made your choice. But,
yeah.
But, you know, I wouldn't have it any other way, really, for that song. I think if you substituted a lot of different chords for that, it would ruin the song.
It would take away from the simplicity of it, and then probably from the lyrics. So that's my excuse anyway.
Well, don't need excuse, because simplicity in this kind of music that's the hardest thing in a way to achieve. You know, just you have to trust it, don't you?
Yeah, sometimes it's harder to play something really simple and really really basic than to like make it fancy and pretty it up with chords.
But the main thing is that you've clearly had your heart in that song.
Well, if a song makes me smile while I sing it, then I'm happy with it.
That's a pretty good guideline for just about any singer to have.
I think so. Yeah, and I hope it puts a smile on other people's faces that are listening to it.
Yeah, and then you could mix that in with a little "One for My Baby" and "One for the Road," just
so. If somebody else plays it.
Roby, thanks a lot for coming on the show. Great.
Thank
to have
you for having me.
Hey, my pleasure. Sister Roby Kahakalau performs songs from her new CD, Roby Calling, in concert Saturday at Hawaii Public Radio's Atherton Studio. Details are on our website, hpr2.org, where you can also find Derek Malama's extended interview with Sister Roby.
It's 2:45. There's no one in the place except you and me. So set 'em up, Joe. I got a little story I think you should know. We're drinking, my friend, to the end of a brief episode. Make it one for my baby and one more for the road.
Didn't want that one to end.
I know. Good people on the show today.
Good people and good music.
Yeah. Good interaction all the way around. That's what we like, isn't it?
It's, yeah, and sometimes we get lucky that we get to end on a high note like this one with Roby. We don't get to see a whole lot of her around these parts. But yeah, nice that Derek Malama has a nice extended interview with her. You got to play with her. You got to play with her this morning.
Good fun, yeah. And you know, I really liked what she said about the importance of creating, you know, thinking about, for any artist, thinking about what the content of your message is. And her emphasis on being very optimistic in her music.
And I think we don't hear enough optimism. Maybe because it's not, in some cases, optimistic times in some ways, other times certainly. But the message often gets lost just in the beat of a song. So often, you know, kids will be listening to something and have no idea what the
right,
message is.
Yeah, exactly.
Better to be a good message, but that takes us looking in, right?
Exactly.
Well, thanks so much. Really enjoyed that last segment. That's going to do it for us for today. Up tomorrow, two views of GMO Ground Zero on Kauai.
And bringing a brand new orchestra to the people and the challenge of bringing people to the orchestra.
That's always a big challenge, isn't it? Got a conversation the rest of us should hear? Well, you can talk back to your radio or on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, or you can tweet us at HI Conversation or get to me at BecauseHPR. You can hear today's show again, too, can't they?
And get another past show. Our links to more information on the HPR2 website, hpr2.org. I'm Chris Vanderkook.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We'll meet you in the morning for more of The Conversation.